Jonah Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Jonah Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
Sorry, Damien. I started talking and I forgot to turn my mic on. You know, just it's a Monday. It's a Monday. Okay.
It happens.
Let's start that again. Hello, and thank you for joining me this Monday, July 19th. Sounds a lot better with a microphone on. Yeah, I know, I know. I want to share with you some big local Chicago news right now. It looks like some kind of agreement has been worked out between the mayor, the city council, and activist groups about exactly what civilian oversight of the Chicago Police Department is going to look like. Okay, here we go. Now, remember, tomorrow, the Public Safety Committee is going to vote on this proposal at 5 p.m. Then it is going to go to the full city council Wednesday, the 21st, at their regular 10 a.m. meeting, where the city council is expected to vote to pass this ordinance. Some of the people who were very frustrated that more didn't happen on this earlier, one of their complaints was that there wasn't going to be enough time to look over the newly negotiated ordinance. Now it looks like they're going to have that time. Well, you know, a day, really a day. Do you want more than a day? That's just asking for too much. Here's what we know. Some of this is reporting from Heather Chiron for TTW. Some of it is Fran Spielman in today's Sun Times. Some of it is a press release, a very brief press release from the mayor's office. Okay, there's going to be, this is at least the ordinance. Now, it still has to get through the Public Safety Committee tomorrow and be approved by the city council on Wednesday. And as we've learned in Chicago, nothing is a done deal until it happens. So here's the proposed ordinance. It's going to create a 7-person commission. The civilian oversight of the Chicago Police Department, 7 people on it. They cannot fire the police superintendent, which is a power that activists wanted. But this 7-member commission can take a vote of no confidence in whoever is the police superintendent. That vote of no confidence would require 5 of the 7 to pass. They can also, they're allowed to take no confidence votes for the chief administrator of COPA and any police board member. Okay, well, you're saying that's all well and good, Joan. But if they can't fire these people, what good does a vote of no confidence do? Well, let me tell you that. This is according to reporting from Fran Spielman in the Sun-Times. A no confidence vote by the commission, this 7-person commission, 5 of whom would have to vote that they had no confidence in whether it's the superintendent or the head of COPA or any members of the police board. Okay. That vote would trigger a vote by the City Council's Committee on Public Safety. And that vote by the committee would have to take place within 2 weeks of the no confidence vote. Okay. After that, whatever the Public Safety Committee votes, yay or nay, that would be looked at by the full city council at its next meeting. Okay, if 2/3 of the aldermen agree, let's say there's a no confidence vote, 5 of the 7 board members say no confidence in the police superintendent, goes to the city council public safety committee within 2 weeks. They also agree, no confidence. We are, a majority of us say no confidence in the superintendent. Then it goes to the city council at their next meeting. 2/3 of the aldermen would have to agree with that no confidence vote and then say the chief administrator of COPA would be removed. Okay. That's how it would work for the head of COPPA. Fran Spielman says, though, that there's sort of a cutout, that if there's a no confidence vote in the superintendent or any of the board members, the mayor would not be bound to follow through. This is exactly what she has wanted. She has wanted more of a civilian advisory committee, not really a civilian oversight committee. But you got to have the votes. If you want to have oversight, you've got to have the votes. And there were enough people falling in line with what the mayor wanted, maybe not to get the mayor's way, but certainly to keep the activists from getting what they wanted. So here's the compromise. Okay. If there is a no confidence vote, say on the superintendent, the mayor has 14 days to respond in some way, to take some action or not, to explain what the mayor's doing and why. Fran Spielman seems to be of the opinion that a no confidence vote, whether or not it results in the firing of the police superintendent, would still be such a big and such a public signal of displeasure that whether they wanted to or not, whoever was mayor would have to take some kind of action. That's the belief. That's the belief. If you want all the nitty-gritty details, Fran Spielman goes into it in great detail. Heather Sharon shares a lot of the statements coming out of the mayor's office. For instance, they first released this, that after a weekend of productive negotiations, they're pleased to announce that the parties have reached agreement on a proposed substitute ordinance for the civilian oversight of the Chicago Police Department, the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, and the Police Board. Again, I think oversight is a strong word. Input into, influence. Anyway, that's my little annotation. If passed, this ordinance would bring a historic, transformative, and balanced approach to civilian oversight. So we shall see. It looks like there are at least 34, if not 36 votes for this ordinance. So unless something unforeseen happens, which is always possible, it looks like this is going to get voted on Wednesday morning. Lots of people have strong feelings about this. Let's go to the phone lines. Steve is calling in from the Gold Coast. Hey, Steve, how are you?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I think that this embodies, you know, politics in Chicago. If we were having this discussion a year ago, I think this ordinance would look very different. But given the context in which we're having it, you know, this year, especially this summer, you know, you tune in any Monday morning, the lead story is going to be, okay, how many people were shot in Chicago this past weekend? How many were killed? Public safety is the number one issue when you ask Chicagoans as to what their concerns are. Residents, businesses, the tourism industry, I mean, you know, everything is being affected by this notion of, you know, are people going to come back? You ask anybody nationally, they would swear that Chicago looks like, you know, Syria. You know, they really do believe that the entire city, you know, is someplace where you walk down the street and you have to duck down for fear of getting shot every 2 minutes from some drive-by shooting or whatnot. And as a result of which, again, there's this fear that industry doesn't want to come here, that people, we get about 50 million tourists in Chicago. We're in the top four cities in the entire country in terms of tourism. And those are figures from 1990. Now, we're trying to recover that in the post-COVID age. But in order to get people back here, they have to feel safe. That's number one on anybody's agenda when it comes to the city. And I think that what this allows people to do is to, on the one hand, say, I supported, you know, oversight of police. Okay, great. Except that when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, okay, what did you really support? Does it have any teeth? And, you know, and no matter where you stand on this, because I'm not offering an editorial on people's ideology, whether you think police need to oversight and reform the criminal justice system and whatnot. What I'm saying is that in light of the priorities of this summer relative to crime and other things, that you've got this tightrope that politicians are trying to walk. That on the one hand, they want to recognize that there is this desire on the part of large segments of the community to reform policing. And on the other hand, there's a desire on the part of many people in large cities, New York, Chicago, L.A., or across the country, to keep crime under control, which is has exploded at levels that we have not seen in decades, quite frankly. And so how do you walk that tightrope? Well, you can support something like this, and you can, and therefore you don't have to worry about getting, say, primary the next time you run for office by somebody who's going to say,
you didn't keep your promise. Yeah,
exactly. So you can mm-hmm. you can say, well, I supported oversight, but then at the same time, you know, you can argue that, oh, no, I'm for law and order and I support the police. So that's the tightrope everyone's walking in America, even progressives, you know.
And in Chicago, you know, before we had the ECPS, we had two different proposals, which would have had greater influence, more teeth. But there wasn't any proposal that had enough votes to get through. So I understand everybody coming together. I mean, it's a typical negotiation. Everybody gets a little bit of something about what they want, and nobody gets everything about what they want. I still personally, Steve, feel that it's a little bit disingenuous to call this an ordinance of civilian oversight. I would say civilian input, civilian influence, but oversight, when the final word still rests with other parties, it isn't oversight so much as it is having a voice.
Right. And it's been called something analogous to what you get at the airport in terms of, you know, when you take off your shoes and, you know, they examine your luggage. And so it's security theater, not so much security. And this is sort of oversight theater, because when you actually look into the nitty gritty of it, you know, are you really getting very much in the way of reform? If something that's toothless, I mean, what reform does it really represent?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what, if any, comments are made. I believe that there are enough votes to get this passed, but I don't think every alderman is going to sign on. And I think there are going to be some interesting critiques in Wednesday morning's meeting. So thanks for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. Well, we need to take a break. There are other callers who want to weigh in on this topic. We are going to get to your phone calls right after this.
Don't want to call but have something to say?
Am I on the air?
You can now text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
This morning it was announced that the city of Chicago has come to an agreement over what civilian input into the Chicago Police Department is going to look like over the weekend. The mayor and the alderman who supported ECPS negotiated, and they have a deal that they believe they can get out of the Public Safety Committee tomorrow at 5 o'clock and voted on by the Chicago City Council Wednesday morning. It gives this 7-member civilian board the power to take a no confidence vote, but that no confidence vote, whether it's for the superintendent or the head of COPA or any of the police board members, that will not in and of itself result in a firing. There are, depending upon the office, other steps that have to take place. And ultimately, that power to fire is going to rest with the mayor, which is exactly what she wanted. So, input? Yes. Oversight? I'm not so sure. Let's go back to the phone lines. Gus is calling in from Logan Square. Hey, Gus.
How you doing, Joan? Great to be on. I got a lot of complicated opinions about this. To me, the best case scenario, this is just dinner theater. Let's be frank. Are you really going to get 2/3 of the city legislator to actually vote on certain things? I mean, those guys couldn't agree where to go to lunch. And let's be frank, right now, we're only seeing a certain level of resistance because the mayor herself is ridiculously unpopular and will be a one-termer. I mean, let's start with, at a national level, we just over-criminalize too much. If we legalize drugs, half the shootings would be gone, but that's another story for another day. But all this advisory, is it really going to lead to firings? No.
Well, I agree with you. I don't necessarily think a no confidence vote is going to lead to a firing, but I think the people who have signed on to this deal believe that if a board like this takes a no confidence vote, there will be so much public pressure, there will be so much reporting on what is going on, that there will be a lot of pressure on the mayor to do something, to react in some way. So is it the power to fire? No. Do I wish it were? Yes. But
yeah, but at the same time, sorry if I come up, but that's the other thing is, and what happens when we elect the mayor everybody likes, and then they go nuts and fire anybody they want? I understand the merits of the issue. I don't know. I just don't think it can be executed, to be honest with you. I know something has to be changed, but frankly, this just seems like they want to shut the voters up.
Yeah, I don't think you're entirely wrong there, Gus. I don't think you're entirely wrong. Thanks for calling in. A couple other things that I wanted to mention before we get going with some guests today. President Biden gave a talk today. And, you know, what's usually to me is the most interesting is not necessarily the speeches, but the Q&A with the White House press corps after the speech, because that's where the press corps hones in on what is important. Remember, we played that sound from Jen Psaki last week where she said there's basically 12 people who are responsible for 60 to 65% of all the vaccine misinformation on social media, particularly on Facebook. Well, President Biden was asked about that. You know, Facebook, because, well, don't get me started. Okay, let's not go there, Joan. Facebook did not respond well to that. It's kind of like, you know, they're like, we're so good and we've done all these good things and look at us. I'm sorry. I have so little sympathy for them, really. Minuscule. It is like at the atomic level, I have that much sympathy for Facebook. They are making money hand over fist. If they're smart enough to do all these algorithms, they're smart enough to figure out who these 12 sites are, who these 12 accounts are. If Jen Psaki can figure it out, you tell me Facebook can't? So why are they still up? Accounts like this a lot of times don't get taken down because they generate traffic. They generate traffic. And you know what traffic leads to? Traffic leads to ad revenue. And that means Mark Zuckerberg gets even richer. I'm having a moment. So anyway, Jen Psaki says there's these accounts that are spreading the bulk of the misinformation. Facebook is like, whoa, no, don't come after us. We do so much that's good. And so President Biden was asked about that. He tried to kind of thread the needle here. Tell me what you think. Listen to this. Vaccine, the Biden bite about vaccine, Damien?
It was pointed out that Facebook, of all the misinformation, 60% of the misinformation came from 12 individuals. That's what the article said. So I was asked that question about what do I think is happening? Facebook isn't killing people. These 12 people are out there giving misinformation. Anyone listening to it is getting hurt by it. It's killing people. It's bad information. My hope is that Facebook, instead of taking it personally, that somehow I'm saying Facebook is killing people, that they would do something about the misinformation, the outrageous misinformation about the vaccine.
Yeah, but you know what, President Biden? By leaving this stuff up there and allowing it to spread, Facebook is killing people. This is one of those instances where if you had one of these, if you had Donald Trump or one of these crazy Republicans and Facebook pushed back, they would double down. And I frankly think President Biden should have doubled down. He said, yeah, Facebook, yeah, that's what we said and that's what we meant. What are you going to do about it? How about that as a response? Instead of, well, you know, I was talking about the misinformation. I wasn't talking about Facebook per se, but they're spreading the misinformation. Good God. Just call it. Yeah, that's what I meant, Facebook. What are you going to do about it? Instead of waffling and whiffling and denying, what are you going to do about it? You know, I thought from the get-go that Trump was a liar and a grifter. But I think part of what appealed to some people was the fact that he didn't give a crap. He didn't care if he hurt feelings. If he saw something, well, if he felt that there was a popular sentiment to have, I don't think he's thoughtful enough to actually come up with anything on his own, he would say it. And if he got pushback, he would double down. And sometimes people get tired of politicians being mealy-mouthed. Nobody wants to offend anybody, especially not anybody with resources that could mean big donations. So let's be really careful about what we say and not hurt any feelings. That's my take on it. What's yours? While we ponder these questions, let's take a break. Shia Kapos, who writes my favorite statewide information newsletter, Illinois Playbook, is going to join us right after this.
Take Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive with you on the go by using the TuneIn app on your phone. Just search for WCPT 820. Don't turn that dial.
A dangerous mistake to make.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive. Returns right now on WCPT 820.
And not just Joan Esposito, but also Shia Kapos, who writes Politico's Illinois Playbook. It is a newsletter that comes out every day to tell you everything that is going on in the state of, well, every day, Monday through Friday, or no holidays, or when she is taking time off. But the rest of the time, it is there in your inbox every morning. And nobody works harder to let you know what is going on in Chicago and throughout the state of Illinois than Shia does. Welcome, Shia. How have you been?
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm good, even though it's Monday.
Yeah. We're kind of having a Monday here. I started the show, forgot to turn my mic on. Damien was obviously going out to get something to eat. He didn't hear when I asked for the Joe Biden sound. It is just Monday. We're counting on you, Shia, to raise the level of this program. Can you do that for us?
I can, but I will try.
There's first and foremost, in today's column, I was stunned to find out all of the places in the state of Illinois that have overtly offensive names, places named with Negro in their name and squaw in their name. You know, being as we live in this blue state, lots of times, at least for me, I feel like I'm on my high horse looking down at these other red states and all the things they do. And I was reading through all of these places, and I frankly had to get down off my high horse. This is amazing. How did you learn about this?
Well, Axios had a national story where they pointed out that there are, you know, more than 1,000 places all across the country that have these names, and you know, nobody hears about them because they've just been part of the culture forever, and maybe they're little tiny small little creeks and streams that nobody really goes to anymore, but they still have this name attached to them. And so there's the link there. You can look and see what your state has. And I started looking and was stunned and surprised, including, you know, in Cook County and Lake County, you know, places in part of Illinois that you wouldn't really expect language like that still to be part of the vernacular. But there it is, you know. In Illinois, it was Laughing Squaw Sloths in Cook County. You know, that's not a word that you expect.
Big Negro Creek in Warren County. Big Negro Creek. How do people look at those signs every day and somebody not say, you know, maybe we ought to rename this?
Yeah, you know, I got emails after I posted this morning, both sides, you know, people surprised, but then somebody was like, you know that that's not a word that you use, but it's just like part of history or something. I don't know. It's
Yeah, you know what, though? That's, I don't think that's an excuse. I mean, there were lots of slurs for Italian people. You know, if it was Big Dago Creek in Warren County, I would want that changed. That would offend me.
Yeah, you know, there is, I did search other racist words, and Dago is one of the words that I searched, and there is a bar, because I guess it wasn't just places, but there were businesses that were in there, too. And there's a bar that uses the word Dago in it. And then it became like a rabbit hole. You know, I'm looking, I had to look up, you know, racist words and then plug racist word in Illinois and try and find all of them. But, you know, the word Negro, the word squad, those I think are the most glaring and stunning and startling and upsetting words that are still out there that people, you know, have used. So
I know that you've done a lot of reporting on a lot of different subjects. What do you think should be done with the problematic statues that are being pulled down and taken away? I've had my suggestion for a while is that you find a big parcel of land and you create a museum, and all of these problematic statues, you move there, and then you do a big educational campaign, and you talk about it, you know, and here's probably, you know, the thinking and how it came, and this is why it became problematic, and here's the history. I think something like that could be a huge, huge learning experience. And I'm not just talking about Confederates. I mean, the Italian-American community in Chicago is still divided on what to do with the statues of Christopher Columbus and whether they should be put back out, and if so, where, in what context. What do you think?
I'm not opposed to your idea, you know, because I don't really, you know, what's the word, renovate. I don't stand before those statues and think, wow, you know, Christopher Columbus at all. But I do, I wonder, is it worth, you know, putting them on a scale of 1 to 10? Maybe Christopher Columbus could stay there, but next to that statue is an important plaque that explains why he wasn't the good guy that, unfortunately, the history books tried to paint him as, you know, that there's another story to him, another element. I do think that that should be incorporated in a lot of these, that you can't just put it up there and leave it. You have to obviously offer the other side. But then there are some that should just be taken down completely. Why do we even have them at all? I don't know.
And, you know, people are always saying, well, you know, there was a statue of Abraham Lincoln that was taken down. But part of the reason it was taken down is it showed a Native Nations person and somebody else, an African-American, who were kneeling in front of him. You know, and I think the idea was that they were so grateful to him, but still awkward, uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think there's a range. Maybe that's the one that gets taken away. But a portrait of Abraham Lincoln, you know, that could stay. But then you offer, you know, a full explanation of his, you know, how slavery plays a role in his life. You know, I could see that with a lot of the statues around. I mean, I live next to Indian Boundary Park, and I think there's a monument there that's also being, you know, under question because of how it's depicted of Native Americans. So, and I think it's okay to change names of places, you know?
Yeah.
We changed Sears Tower, and we all got over it. So...
Well,
their names, and I think everything would turn out just fine.
Well, I won't let them take your name off of all the buildings that I know someday it's going to be on. Sia, we need to take a break a little bit later today. I'm going to be talking to David Orr, who, as you know, since his retirement from government has been deeply involved with an organization called Good Government Illinois, and they have talked about ethics reform. And ethics reform is something that you touch on in your column today. You know what? We just got a caller on this subject. So I'm going to take Dave from Hoffman Estates before we go to break. Hey, Dave, you're on with Joan and Shia.
Hey, Joan. Hey, Shia. Now,
hi.
I feel with the statue bit, it's history. You know, may not be good. You could be like, it feels like you're whitewashing it a bit, like what Japan did with the atrocities. They never put it in their textbooks for some of these of the newer generation. And as I told the screener, with the statues, in some ways I feel it's a red herring. How come nobody's ever got upset about the highway in front of the National Marine Corps Museum in Triangle, Virginia? It's the Jefferson Davis Highway.
Ooh.
Oh.
They never want to change that.
I don't know. The military, if the military has anything to say about it, they will, because the current leadership has put out an order that every base named for anybody from the Confederacy, those names are going to be changed. But I don't know if they would have jurisdiction over a street. But, you know, towards your point, rather than just destroying all these statues, that's why I like the idea of creating this, you know, the history you never knew, but maybe you should have, or the background for all these people who some people really think are great, but maybe not so great in everything they did. That's why I think that it could be a wonderful occasion to educate people, you know, now that we're starting to kind of wake up and realize that, just as you said, Dave, like Japan, we did not always report the ugly parts of our history. Thanks for the call. Shia and I are going to take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk. She wrote a little bit about ethics and an ethics bill in Springfield. We're going to talk to her about that when we come back.
Facebook.
Message us.
Instagram.
Follow us.
Twitter.
Tweet us.
They keep me connected.
Let's get social on the socials. WCPT 820.
Because facts matter. You are listening to WCPT 820.
Now back to Joan Esposito. Live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
In today's Illinois Playbook, Shia Kapus, who is our guest right now, it is a great newsletter. You should read it. You should sign up for it. It is free. It is wonderful. If you have any interest in having any idea what is going on in the state of Illinois, that's one-stop shopping for you. There's a legislative update section, and it is titled House GOP Requests a Mandatory Veto of Ethics Bill. What do you think about that, Shia? And explain to the audience exactly what you wrote about.
Well, what's interesting is Republicans voted for this bill. So it was a bipartisan bill. But now they're coming back after the legislative inspector general announced she was going to step down because she's frustrated with what is in this bill, that it doesn't go far enough to really let her or anyone in that position do their job. And so now Republicans are saying, okay, let's do a veto and tweak it some more. We need to do more with ethics. What she is concerned, among the many things that the inspector general is concerned about, is that the bill says, okay, you know, only when somebody files a complaint can you start this investigation. And only can you examine when government or employment by a lawmaker is in question. You can't, you know, if they're doing revenge porn, that's not related to their work, so you can't investigate that. And she's saying, hey, you know, we should have a little broader power to do investigations. And so there's a debate about that. You know, it improves some on ethics more, you know, but not enough. And the legislative inspector general wants more, and now Republicans are saying they want more done too. I know the House Speaker says the bill is a good start. He wants it to pass, and I think we expect the governor to sign it. That hasn't happened yet, however.
Well, I understand part of what Carol Pope is saying, inspector generals always are in a kind of a weird place. You know, the rules under which they are set to operate are set by many times by the people they're actually supposed to be investigating, which is an interesting relationship. But I do agree. I do agree with the legislators on one point. I mean, if she wants to say, oh, by the way, I investigated Chia Kapos and I found that I didn't find any reason to proceed. I agree with the legislators because, you know, I mean, human nature, you're going to think, well, Chia Kapos, what was she investigated for? And is it that they didn't get enough of proof against her, or is she really innocent? And I think that no politician is going to want that kind of talk swirling around them. And frankly, it could potentially be fuel for somebody who wants to run against them. These kinds of, well, you know, she was investigated. There must have been something there. You know, there must have been some smoke. And so I can understand that. But you're right. I mean, this bill passed. Some of these same people saw this bill that they now want to amend. And frankly, it wasn't even all the Republican members. There were, 34 people? So my sense is that, they're going to make a little noise and maybe hope that down the road that gets them a little something extra. But I don't think that they realistically expect that there is going to be an amendatory veto. Do you?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that hasn't been discussed beyond this, this report about or Republicans wanting it right now. So, the Democrats control both, sides of the legislature. They control the governor's office. So I don't see them, appeasing Republicans for this.
Because
she was pretty forthright about being concerned that, you know, she didn't have enough leeway to do the job properly. So that's serious stuff, but legislators still have control of it. And so I think they're moving on.
One thing I want to ask you about, I was talking to somebody about ethics reform last week. And I think I might have even read the original reporting on this in Illinois Playbook that, you know, a House Speaker Chris Welch had put forth legislation that would codify term limits. And recently, Senate President Don Harmon was like, we're not going to take that bill up. We don't need that. We've already got this policy, these rules that govern term limits. But it was pointed out by many people that having a rule is not the same thing as having to follow a law, that, you know, rules can be changed. They can be changed quite quickly. And I was talking to somebody about that. And they implied that perhaps Don Harmon was sort of filling the vacuum of power left by Mike Madigan, that he was sort of stepping in and being, if not the new Mike Madigan, certainly more than the state Senate president was before Mike Madigan. Do you see something like that happening? Do you think Don Harmon is filling this void?
Well, he's only been in for a year and a half, so I don't know that we can presume that yet. But yes, I mean, when that bill first passed the House, I mean, it was like trumpeted from the sky. Oh, my God. You know.
Yeah. It was like, yes, we've waited so long. Somebody's finally following through on the promise. Woohoo!
Yeah. And so then, and I'm to blame, too. I mean, I think we all, reporters, we were worried about energy legislation. We're worried about all these, you know, the school board bill. We're worried about all this other legislation. And then somebody pointed out to me, like, that never actually passed the Senate. It's gone. And so I went back and looked. I'm like, oh, my God, yes. So and then that's and then I talked to the Senate team and they said, well, it's not really necessary because we have this rule and it's just as you explained, and what you don't realize, of course, is the rule can be broken. And that, I mean, I guess we'll find out in 8.5 years whether Don Harmon is, you know, still Senate president and wants to be around even longer. So,
But eight years from now, if he continues to amass influence and power, and if he also, like Mike Madigan, has access to a huge war chest where he can dole out or take away campaign funds, I mean, would we really be shocked if 8 years from now he's like, oh, you know that rule? Well, you know, I carry, this is my favorite argument, Shia. I have all this institutional knowledge and I'm at a place where I can really get things done. And if I leave and somebody new comes in, they're going to have to start from scratch and it's just going to be terrible. I mean, my God, how many times have we heard that, Shia?
Right. Well, we've seen that change can happen and pretty seamlessly. Chris Welch has moved in. He has, you know, guided his first legislative session, made more difficult by the fact that it was amid COVID and difficult because redistricting is going on, and they did fine. So change is fine, even after somebody's been in 40 years before you. There is an issue about influence in terms of fundraising. I mean, Don Harmon already has a powerful war chest and is powerful in helping get his caucus elected. And I think we'll be able to know more about how Democrats do in 2022 than we do right now, I think. Democrats have a whole other problem because of the Democratic Party's the way the leadership is formed. They're having some struggles there. But, I don't know if Don Harmon will be the next Michael Madigan.
wait and see. Stay tuned, as they say. One of the things that I like about your column is that it's always a roundup of different stories from different news sources all around the state of Illinois. Go ahead.
Our publications all over the state do really good work.
Yeah. Yes.
The channel is trying to find, you know, the best story. Sometimes I go back and forth when I'm writing about Chicago City Council because I think Fran Spielman does an incredible job for the Sun-Times, but it can't be the Fran Spielman show. So then I also go to the Tribune, and I go to WTTW, WBEZ. I try to mix it up a little bit. So,
Well, today, for example, you have a link to a story from Illinois Farmer Today, and you have a link to a story from the Effingham Daily News. So I would say you are you're very good at sifting what is interesting and important from a lot of different news sources, not just Fran Spielman.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, you want to give people a taste for what people are talking about all over the state, because it's not just Northern Illinois that is running the show. So
what's one or two things from today's newsletter that, if indeed there was something that when you first read the original source, you were kind of like, huh, really?
Well, my lead item is a scoop. Nobody's had that. And I was excited to find out about it. So, and that is that Nikki Budzinski, who used to work for Governor J.B. Pritzker and went to Washington, D.C. to work for the Office of Management and Budget under Joe Biden, that she's decided to come back. She's been there for 6 months, and now she's coming home. She said she had a great experience. She just wanted to be back in Illinois doing work here. So that was a fun scoop, and I think insiders, people, because part of the readership of Illinois Playbook, it's like super insider lawmaker people, and then it's regular people who just want to be able to, you know, go to one place for all of their news and get a good feeling for what's happening in the state. But the insiders were loving that because they did not know that. So that was fun.
So that was the kind of thing that gave you a little bit of a frisson of excitement this morning.
Yes, I was excited. I heard about it through a source last week. And so she and I had been kind of talking about the right time that she would talk to me and talk to me first. You know, I want to be able to give people news first and to rely on me having scoops. And hopefully when you read Illinois Playbook, you're reading it and you are ahead of the of what's going on in for the rest of the day. Like a lot of other media will follow me afterwards. I imagine the Nikki Butskupski story will come up in other media probably later in the week. So,
I want you to sit down with her for an in-depth interview. When you got to the part in your discussion with her where she talked about trying to shift from Donald Trump to Joe Biden, it was toxic. There are stories there, Shia. We need to know those stories.
Well, you have all these, I think 500 of the 700 employees for OMB in Washington are permanent government employees. And so it's been a painful, stressful time for them. And that transition was hard for a lot of them. So, yeah, I think she has a lot of stories to tell. But I'm sure she won't be telling them.
Oh, that's the problem with some of these people. I have a scoop for you. Well, it's not my scoop. It's from Heather Chiron from TTW. And this is one of those scoops that everyone is going to yawn as soon as I say it. Governor Pritzker's decided to run for re-election.
Yay!
And, you know, with an announcement like that, the only scoop is, like, what day the video drops.
Yeah. Well, I've been working on a piece about why it's taken him so long to announce. And tomorrow I'll have that explains
excellent.
Why.
Excellent. So, all right. Yeah. Illinois Playbook. Sign up for it. It will be in your email box first thing in the morning. And now we will get the inside story from Shia about why Governor Pritzker waited this long. Shia, thanks so much. It's fun to talk with
you.
And I love, love, love your newsletter. Even when, you know, you write about names that I don't recognize, I click on the links and I'm always better educated when I'm done. Thank you.
Love it. Thanks, Joan. Fun talking to you and your friends on the air.
We are going to take a break now for news at the top of the hour. And then, as promised, David Orr from Good Government Illinois is going to be joining us. We'll be back after this.
There's no excuse to miss Joan Esposito.
It's number one on my stereo.
Live, local, and progressive. You can listen to her daily at WCPT820.com on your computer or phone. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive.
Quite frankly, I get most of my news from you.
Joan Esposito.
Y'all ready for this?
On WCPT 820.
David Orr, after leaving government, joined Good Government Illinois, an organization where he works for sunlight and transparency and ethics reform. He is one of our favorite people to talk to here. He has a new town hall coming up. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But now just welcome, David. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Joan. Thanks for having me on.
Are you having the best summer ever?
I'm having a good summer considering all the trouble out there and the virus is still around. Yes, I'm enjoying myself. Thank you. And I'm beginning to get out and went to nice concert in Logan Square, nice little jazz band yesterday afternoon. So it's fun to do things, although I'm still a little wary because of my age, I guess.
Well, I know what you mean. I've ventured out a couple of times, and it feels weird. You know, things that I never would have thought twice about doing before. I'm just very conscious of being, like, in the moment. I'm very conscious of being near other people. It's just this, I don't know, it's a very strange feeling.
It is, and in my case, particularly as a former politician, I went dancing at a kind of a fun place. And there's all these people coming up, and they want to say hello, and yet you don't particularly want to shake their hands. I mean, realizing how many people are now beginning to get sick. I don't mean sick with COVID. Just, you know, people have here in the sense that they haven't been getting the traditional colds. And there's something valuable about us being careful, but nobody wants to be too crazy about it. But it is a good feeling. Let's just hope we can convince some folks in some of these more rural areas to get the vaccine.
It really is... It really is, as one expert, I think it was Rochelle Walensky, said that we now have a pandemic of the unvaccinated. I mean, just a few weeks ago, I think it was all the hospitalizations and infections that took place. I can't remember. It was a southern state, but all the hospitalizations and all the deaths in a given week, they were all unvaccinated people. And I've said this on the air before. When we were in the throes of COVID, I got so tired, whether it was, you know, NBC News or MSNBC or CNN or ABC Evening News. I got so tired of the stories that reporters would do as some, you know, ultra right wing Trumper would be in the hospital, you know, giving an interview saying, I didn't think COVID was real, but it's I got so sick and please listen to me. And now, David, the stories that I'm seeing are people being hospitalized saying, if I had it to do over again, I would get the shot. And it's like, does no one pay attention? David, I got really frustrated at the beginning of the show today. I thought that Jen Psaki did a great job when she came out and she said, look, we've identified 12 people who are, or 12 sites responsible for 65% of the misinformation about COVID. They're still up and running on Facebook. And when Facebook whined and complained, you know, Joe Biden today was, well, we're not saying it's Facebook. We're saying it's the misinformation that just happens to be on Facebook. And I said to myself, you know what? Somebody has got to say, stop it. I believe that Facebook is killing people by letting this stuff stay up there. And it just makes me so mad.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, when we talk about government and whether we use the word good government, et cetera, we're talking about leadership, okay? And leadership is really important, and the terrible job that Trump did on the virus and how he had so much who was spreading it. I mean, so it's leadership and accountability. And we're also, we're a country that loves our individualization, but we also don't realize, or some people don't, is you need collective action. Some of the best step forwards we've taken is like collective action. When governments were able to finally come up with ways to have clean water and deal with the sewage and so forth. Amazing mm-hmm. victories. But we're still stuck with this notion of individualism. And I have the right to do whatever I want, even if I cause you and people around me to die. And it goes back. It's when people who become not so much conservative, but almost right-wing, this argument they can do anything they want, and they forget, you know, we want people to have as much freedom as possible, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. So yeah. It's we're always back and forth, and when you have what I consider pretty bad, irresponsible leadership, not only do the nuts come out from the right and the racists and other kinds of things, well, I don't mean all people, I just mean you see folks... And you get these other people, and they spread these ignorant theories. And I don't mean conservative. I just mean ignorant theories, and that hurts. But let's look at the good side. Leadership from Trump and other people and individuals in the medical industry. And we have to keep pushing because more and more people I know that fought against it, fought against getting vaccinated, are doing it. I just wish it was a little faster pace. So I'm a little bit hopeful there.
Yeah. Before we go to break, we have a caller. Jim is calling from Chicago to join our conversation. Hey, Jim, you're on with Joan and David Orr.
Thanks, Joan. Hi, David. DeSantis finally came out this morning. How are you? DeSantis is probably the front runner for the Republican nomination. If we live to see 94, whatever heck year it's going to be. He finally came out this morning and said, let's get a vaccination. So I think that somebody, his handlers probably told him, you know, you got to get a couple of private Republicans to start demanding everybody get vaccinated.
You know, where did you see that, you. Jim? I'd like to.
This morning, I heard it this morning, Joan. He made a plea to get vaccinated.
Huh. I'm going to look that up. That would be nice.
Yeah, but, that would be, you think that somebody would, you know, a Republican would come forward and start, you know, get these people off their rumps to get a vaccination. Anyway, thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. David, let's take a quick break. And I'm speaking with David Orr. He is with Good Government Illinois. When we come back, I want to ask him about what she and I were just talking about. I was talking with Shia Kapos, and today she reported that 34 Republican state lawmakers in Illinois wanted an amendatory veto of the current ethics bill based on some of the things that Carol Pope, the inspector general, has said. We're going to talk about that and more right after this.
Don't want to call but have something to say?
Am I in the air?
You can now text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
WCPT 820, Chicago's progressive talk, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I'm speaking with David Orr, who is with Good Government Illinois, and ethics is a big, big, big concern for Good Government Illinois. So I wanted to talk to David Orr about something that Shia Kapos published today in Illinois Playbook, a note that 34 Republican members of the House in the state of Illinois sent a letter to Governor Pritzker asking that an amendatory veto for the ethics bill happen because the legislative inspector general, a woman by the name of Carol Pope, pointed out some things that make it more difficult for her to do her job. Now, it wasn't even the entire Republican House. That would have been 45 legislators. And while this is a wonderful move and it gets them a lot of attention, I don't know that they really expect anything to happen. But David, should something happen based on what Carol Pope has complained about, the difficulties in doing her job and the constraints that she has to live with?
Well, first I'd say, Joan, that whenever we talk about ethics, I always like to use the word fairness and efficiency, because ethics doesn't always grab people, but everybody's concerned about having a government that's more fair and efficient and doesn't waste money and doesn't misuse money helping those who don't need it. Having said that, I think the ethics legislation, particularly for our times, was pretty darn weak. And I'm upset that some of the legislators felt like some of us, the various organizations around the state that made some noise, they almost acted like we were totally out of line. We were in their face. Remember that the context of this is how much trouble we've had and how much corruption we've had. Not just the Commonwealth Edison, but indictments right and left and convictions. So in that context, they didn't do a good job at all. I wouldn't even mind if the governor vetoed it, frankly, and they had to go back to Springfield. With elections coming up, we'd get a better piece of legislation. As for the Republicans, well, maybe a little hypocritical. I do wish there were some amendatory vetoes they could agree with. Mm-hmm. One of the big ones, as you said, if the inspector general is too weak, and I remember how it took years and years in Chicago to give more and more power to the inspector general, particularly at the city level. And it's really important. And I was a politician. I understand how I don't want someone to use it against me. But the silly stuff they have in there and the limits they've had, and the little bit they did in legislation, is really not good. And there was a lot of other things about what they did do, which was just flat-out weak. And it wasn't, in my mind, a first step. It wasn't even a good start, any of those words being used by that. It was a sad start. It was a false start. So I'm glad some Republicans are speaking up. They may be. I'd love to see the Democrats join the chorus. Do it over and do it better.
Well, what about something else I talked to Shia about, these rumblings in some quarters that Don Harmon, the Senate president, is on his way or would like to be the next all-powerful Mike Madigan. In that, Chris Welch made a big deal of there's going to be term limits. We've got this ordinance. They passed it. Yahoo. Everybody's thrilled. Great for them. And then Don Harmon says, no. We're not going to take that up. We don't need it. We already have a rule. We have a rule that says there will be term limits, which, as we know, doesn't carry anywhere near the same weight that an ordinance does. What do you think of all that, David? No big deal or a big deal?
It's a big deal. You're referring to term limits, though, just for leaders, not for legislators.
Yeah,
but for leaders.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Well, again, I don't mind someone having power and using it. But from my point of view, if they're not pushing good, efficient government and fairness and not let with come without us and get away from raising our rate hikes unnecessary, we go on down the list. I want that person to have power, but I don't want them to have it just through, quote, fundraising. I want that to have it like Joe Biden is using, I think, these days, a sort of moral suasion by dealing with some of the issues that the public wants to hear about. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, I'd rather things were real clear, but the key to me here is we need to be pushing those of us that, you know, choose the Democratic Party to always be pushing the party to a more progressive stance on all sorts of issues, including what we call ethics and including how we define party leadership. I understand there's times when you need, you know, you need a bit of clout. OK, but it shouldn't be used the way in which was done with Madigan, as simply you don't support me and even on more conservative policies for the state. And if you don't support me, then I will make it hell for you to run for office. So the point is, I'm a little less concerned about if someone has power. I'm more concerned about how they use the power.
I understand that. And theoretically, David, I agree with it. But like when you said, bringing pressure, like I'm going to give you money to run or I'm going to make sure you don't get any money. When I think in terms of like Joe Biden and Joe Manchin, I wish somebody, whether it's Chuck Schumer or Joe Biden, could go to Joe Manchin and say, look, buddy, you know, your life is going to be a living hell if you don't start getting on board. I understand that there's a fine line for how these things can work out. And there's a fine line where it's what you do is unethical, but sometimes pressure gets things done. I wish somebody had something hanging over Joe Manchin's head that they could beat him up with. Don't you, David?
Absolutely. In other words, pressure is critical. I think all the young activists out there realize pressure, the squeaky wheel, all that is very important. I do think it's a bit of a different situation because there's other things at play here. In other words, as much as we want certain things done, and we'd like Joe Manchin to be more progressive on a number of things, you have to look at the large picture. And the large picture is you've got 50 votes. And let's say that tomorrow they beat up Joe Manchin too much. Okay? Does that help with all the other votes we got coming, all the other issues we have? So I suspect that what Biden's doing, and again, I'm way far away from him, I'm not talking to him every night, I suspect what they're trying to do is lay the conditions where Biden and others, where Manchin and others see that the Republicans, no matter what we do, are going to try and find a way to sabotage or stop decent legislation. But coercing, pushing, any ways we can, I'm all for that. But you have to be careful because you need those 50 votes. And for example, if on some of these big things coming up, that they're going to do it with the 50 Democratic votes, you've got to have that. We do not want to force him, in a sense, into a situation where he'd fight everything that some of the more progressive Democrats are fighting for.
You know, Joe Manchin, it became public recently that he was set to attend a meeting of Republican donors. And a lot of people pointed to that and said, see, he's not really a Democrat. Look at that. He's going to appear before these Republican donors. You know, he's obviously trying to get some money out of him. I understand Joe Manchin's in a tough spot. I understand that he is in a state that is getting redder by the day and that his state really needs, he believes there needs to be bipartisan work. But don't you think he's really more like a Republican than a Democrat? I don't even know why he still is bothering to call himself a Democrat or in the Democratic Party.
Well, I don't know that I'm in a position to answer all that. I would just frankly say good leadership. Like I say, I don't think it's a question of that state could be turned blue or back to blue the way it was. It has lots of workers that were sold a bunch of lies by Trump and others. Going to save coal. Of course, they are not doing it, destroying the air while they're at it. So no, I don't buy that. he's in very powerful positions. He's enjoying it. It's kind of like today's city council. You know, when you don't have a total boss, all of a sudden a lot of individuals have a lot of power. I have a kind of a fine line that I try and approach, because in the larger picture, we need all these people. We need them. So I'm always, like you, looking for pressure points, but I'm not going to be doing a lot of strong rhetoric, treating him as an enemy, looking for the places where we can influence him, but I don't want him as an enemy. We need him until, if we get through 2 years from now and elect some other Democrats to the Senate and we have a little bit of breathing space, that's a little different.
We have about a minute and a half before we have to go to break. But along those lines, you know, the history is that a president who's in power and controls both houses, when the next midterm comes up, that president loses one or both houses. Because of the strange state of the Republican Party, I don't think that history is maybe our best guide. I think it's possible that we might pick up some seats in either or both houses. Do you feel that way? Do you think that's possible? Do you think it's likely?
Right. I think it's possible, and I would say likely dependent on certain conditions. The two key things, okay, are one, let me say one, of course, is just if Biden is able to kind of keep this up, okay, what I mean is seeming to be pushing strongly issues the American people care about, in which they have a strong amount of support. So that the issues are truly bipartisan. The voters are in favor of, even if some of the clowns in the part of the Republican Party fight it all the way. And I'm trying to remember what the second point was, frankly. I know the second one is where you mentioned. The second point is we may get a boost and a benefit from the crazy stuff that the right-wing Republicans are doing and the Trumpites. So those two things together, Biden's popularity proving what maybe a more efficient government that cares about its citizens can do, and add to it, if they keep up pushing their right-wing moniker on everything, resulting in challenges and so forth where Republicans will be weaker in some of those key Senate and House races, I think we have a good shot not to follow the normal historical pattern.
Well, let's take a break. I'm speaking with David Orr from Good Government Illinois. He has a really interesting town hall coming up tomorrow. I want to talk to him about that and his guests on that town hall right after a break.
Need a new social media account to follow for progressive politics? WCPT 820 is your best source for both progressive politics and programming. Give us a like on Facebook and a follow on both Twitter and Instagram. Now back to Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I'm speaking with David Orr. He is with Good Government Illinois. They have some interesting town halls that you can enjoy from the comfort of your own home by clicking on a link. And there is one coming up tomorrow from 7 to 8 p.m. David, tell us about it.
Okay, we kind of just celebrate July 1st being the victory for the minimum wage increase in Chicago. It's kind of a labor show in a way, or a working people show. Our guests are Tom Balanoff, who is the powerful president of SEIU, Local 1 here in Illinois, and a gentleman named Andy Fox, who is a director of an office called the Labor Standards City of Chicago. And there's a lot of things here that people might be interested in because they don't quite realize when we say, for example, how do we fight wage theft? And wage theft, we estimate $400 million stolen from workers in just the Chicago area. $400 million.
What do you mean by that, wage theft?
Yeah, well, wage theft is a very common thing all over the country, billions of dollars nationally. It's basically ways in which employers basically steal wages. A lot of people, particularly the folks, for the most part, not in unions, although it happens there too, not in unions, but they don't get their stubs, or people take money, or they cheat them. So instead of maybe doing 40 hours times this, they just cheat them. And a lot of these people, and some of them are immigrants, some of them may have language issues with it. But the bottom line is that's the estimate of how much money they lose. And there's other kinds of wage theft, like independent contractors. That's become really big in the U.S. In other words, so people, instead of calling them an employee, they call them an independent contractor. And in many mm-hmm. cases, they really are not an independent contractor. And what it means then is the employee doesn't pay the payroll taxes that help when it comes to unemployment and so forth. So it's kind of like when most of private businesses did away with health care and pensions. And it's kind of like socialism for the rich. So they do away with that. And then meanwhile, people have to go to government, okay, to get some sort of relief. And then, of course, sometimes the more conservative groups even fight the government giving Social Security or Medicare or some sort of help for old age. So there's 101 tricks, and this little office of labor standards tries to fight those things. So it's really important. And, of course, Tom Baranoff is a major political figure in the country. I'm sure he'll tell us what he thinks are the most important issues for organized labor and where do they see that they're making progress. I'm sure they're going to be delighted by the federal dollars flowing to Illinois. Those mm-hmm. things that can help with not just infrastructure, but other kinds of programs we need. So, you know, we have limited time, but I really want people to understand what is being done where employees try and cheat often low-level employees. At the same time, we'll celebrate again that the $15 were as of July 1st in Chicago.
We have a caller who wants to talk about election fraud. We'll get back to the union folks that you're going to be talking to in just a second. But Beth is calling in from Wheeling to join our conversation. Hi, Beth. You're on with Joan and David Orr from Good Government Illinois.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I had a question for David Orr, because I think if anybody knows how to run an election, it's him. And
did you say run an election or steal an election?
She said run.
Okay.
In a responsible way, because I was an election judge. I have been for years when you were, you know, in charge, and I still am an election judge. But I mean, when I hear the accusations of mass fraud, I'm like, how could you even do that if you wanted to? You know, I mean, I just want your take on when you hear this.
I think I put it like this. In terms of a large-scale fraud, like President Trump talked about, former President Trump, and some of his Republican backers, I think that's been proven kind of false everywhere. And I particularly like what's happened in Michigan, where some of these attorneys and others may get in big trouble with the courts for pushing issues on based on information they know was not correct when they introduced it. There are things that could be done. A big fear for a lot of people is some sort of fancy computer gimmick. Okay, and there's been a lot of people working on that for years. One of the best people was my former head of elections, a guy named Noah Prates. He wrote the book here in Illinois on what we do to prevent that kind of cheating, you know, where someone might be able to mess up the software in the counting system, okay, within the computers. But there's a lot we can do, and the governments across the country have taken good steps on that. So ironically, most of the fraud we see right now is ironically more on the Republican side. And it's in these things with voter suppression. But there are still cases. I mean, remember, I certainly had a number of cases when I was county clerk. We had a gentleman who worked in the state's attorney's office that was voting both in Lake County, where he lived, and in a Chicago suburb, because he really came out of that suburb and had some political connection to the mayor. Now, we managed to catch that and stop it. But, you know, there's always going to be some of these cases, but it's not overwhelming. But you have to understand what this is. Not only is it a gimmick used very wisely to win Republican support, but it's been a big fundraiser. And what we know about President Trump is he's always looking for money, and he raised hundreds of millions of dollars with these false charges that he controls. Okay, so remember, if maybe you believe former President Trump, but if you see him like me as a pretty good con artist, he knows these things can collect money if he pushes the big lie. The difficulty is the people behind the voter suppression are not dumb. They're smart, and they take things wherever they think they can get away with it. And because our system is different than most countries, the power is at the national level. And they have provinces and so forth. But the national level, it doesn't allow maybe one state to have early vote and another state not. It's supposed to be more uniform. But because Republicans control a certain number of states, now they really want to be kind of a local issue. And passing all this voter suppression is extremely dangerous. And that's why earlier Joan was pushing us on Senator Manchin. We really need to pass a federal act that would give some standing in court and other places. Otherwise, we're going to have these states doing some really terrible things. And, you know, the worst, let me just repeat, is not fining people for giving people water in line or blocking some of these things like having less early voting sites. The worst thing in many of these states is basically saying if the Republican legislation, because it's only in those states that they're doing this, if the Republican legislation doesn't like the results, like in Georgia, they don't like the results in Atlanta. In Michigan, they don't like the results in Detroit, obviously what's going on. So what they could do is throw those local officials out, put their own in, and then let them decide the election. Almost like the governor, the old corrupt governor of Michigan, when he put people in charge of Detroit.
To the
poisoning and the water and so forth. But so, yes, it's gravely exaggerated, but there are examples. There are people that the biggest thing that I know of, for example, is there are a handful of people, maybe five or six, that voted twice that I'm aware of in various elections. They live in Arizona and they own property there and here. And they figured since they own property, they could vote twice, once in each place, although that doesn't necessarily affect other elections. So it's really fairly minimal. It's still important. We should fight it. But they've got themselves a standard bearer that they can jump on. The good news for us is that many, not enough, but many Republicans are actually themselves saying this is BS. It's really going on. So
Let's take a break. I'm talking with David Orr from Good Government Illinois. There is a town hall, a virtual town hall, tomorrow evening, Tuesday evening from 7 to 8, where he is going to be talking to some of our union friends. Let's take a break, and we'll find out more about that when we come back.
Do you want to get in on the conversation? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Entry Lawyers. Visit them at justicestartstoday.com.
This is WCPT 820, where facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
David Orr is with Good Government Illinois, and they often do some really fascinating town halls. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, from 7 to 8 p.m., you can get this via Zoom. Just go to Good Government Illinois, and you can get the link. They're going to be talking to Tom Balanoff and Andrew Fox about things like labor laws, paid sick leave, a fair work week, and minimum wage increases across the board. You know, David, I don't know if this is one of the things that you are going to mention, because I understand that, you know, you want to talk about the nitty gritty of what's going on in Illinois today. But I'm starting to read these things seem to have a cyclical nature. But again, I'm starting to read all these articles on how much more efficient and productive we would be if we had a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week. Realistically, unions it seems these days can barely convince companies that a living wage, a minimum wage that people can support a family on, is a bridge too far. I don't know about this 4-day work week, though the studies that I've seen are pretty clear about how much happier people are, how much more productive they are, how much more they get done. Do you think something like that would ever happen here?
I would have said no a few years ago, but I do see changes. Keep in mind, we're way behind what a lot of European countries do in terms of providing certain benefits and so forth. And that pandemic might have some effect on this, Joan. It's kind of like, you're right. Those companies, and we do have people like that, those businesses that really understand when their workers are happy, everybody's better. Okay. Everybody works mm-hmm. better. There's others that don't seem to care about that. They just want to treat their employees as robots and, you know, get them out the door as fast as possible. You saw those articles on Amazon, that kind of thing. But because of the pandemic and because now that more people be working at home, and because if people are working at home, that may save many of them 2 or 3 hours time commuting. And maybe it means less break time. That's hard to say. Everybody takes breaks even when they're at home. So there may be ways where people realize without coming to the office and the expenses of that, if we can have the right kind of monitoring, there are industries that can do that. Now, there's some perhaps that can't at all. But yes, I think there's some possibilities there. All it takes is a few experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Other issues dealing with, some of the public sector, police, fire, et cetera. But it just takes a few examples where people kind of make it. And we've certainly seen some really good employers that understand, like Costco, people where they pay their employees and seem to care about them, good things happen. So I'm hopeful at that front. There's certainly much more experiments going on in Europe than here.
Well, I know. All the studies I've been reading have been coming out of Europe. The most recent one was Iceland, which was having a real problem with worker morale and productivity. And the industries that have gone to this 4-day week have found a big change. But let's return our focus, David, back here to the state of Illinois and what is going on here. You said you're going to talk to both Andrew and Tom about paid sick leave. Is this tied in with the whole you're an independent contractor thing? Because that's obviously one of the benefits that you wouldn't get if you were on your own.
That's right. And there's other things that we can do there. OK, and part of what Andrew's job is, Tom does these kind of things. The union officially tries to bear down on employees that don't follow the existing rules, okay, bringing non-unionist folks into a work site, et cetera. What Andy Fox in this small office does is they're litigators in some cases, but they try and represent the workers and recover wage theft that was stolen, that kind of thing. And so paid sick leave is a similar thing. There are times when people are supposed to get paid sick leave, they don't. Now, so when there's clear cases of violations, they can deal with that. And there's other answers that are more political. You remember when the county passed that paid sick leave ordinance just, maybe it's been 4 or 5 years now since I've been going a little bit. And organizations like Arise, I hope you're listening tomorrow night, which is a neighbor organization of religious and labor leaders that try and help less fortunate workers. The law was passed, but what happened in Cook County is several suburbs then exempted themselves from the paid, from both the wage increases and the paid sick leave. And so there will be other battles again. And even during the pandemic nationwide, you had places like the chicken industry of all, the horrible chicken industry in a sense of poor working conditions and so forth. And they admitted in several hearings that they don't provide sick leave. And everyone kind of looks at each other for a moment and decides, wait a second, these people are working all those chicken and they're coming in sick. What the heck is going on? So it's time has come. We just haven't got enough industries to realize that it's too dangerous, particularly with the pandemic, to have people come to work when they're sick because they can't afford to get off. So All those are part of this package. And it's kind of like when you said about the four-day work week. When you provide and enforce proper benefits so people can lead a little better life, let's face it, everyone's better when they're, you know, I always had to deal with that. You know, you got employees that are just kind of not hip with their life. They're not real good at customer service.
One thing, I don't know if this is going to come up in your conversation, but as we, well, who knows, with Delta, we may not be out of the COVID world, but I was going to say, as we emerge from this pandemic, is it appropriate for unions to take a position on whether or not their workers need to be vaccinated? I mean, is it, I know that we've already ascertained that there are some businesses that can and should demand that everybody who works for them be vaccinated. But, you know, if you've got a union, let's say you represent all the maids in the hotel business who, you know, have to run into people all the time. Is it appropriate for unions to say, by the way, if you do this job, you need to be vaccinated? Or is that just not the purview of a union?
Well, I think it certainly can be, and I think it is. I know plenty of unions, that particularly here in the Chicago area, have been at the forefront of trying to demand, whether it's the public, the county, the city, whether it's government and or other industries, provide the necessary vaccinations. It was the unions in the chicken industry, in the meat industry nationwide as well, that they knew their people were being forced to work. In fact, Trump had an order that they had to go to work, okay? So unions, at least a lot of them, have been in the forefront of demanding that be available and convenient for their workers. I know lots of people, even in my old office, county clerk's office, were upset that things weren't provided more quickly, and people got COVID, but often the office didn't tell them, and so it spread in ways that didn't need to. But the union was fighting to get the vaccines and to make it easily acceptable. So I think they're kind of on the positive side of that already.
But they can urge it, they can encourage it, they can have vaccination, you know, meetings and availabilities, but is it appropriate for a union to require vaccination of a certain sort of worker?
Well, again, I'm trying to think out loud about that. In other words, the union's not paying them. The union is, like, let's say, my old office, county clerk's office, or public or private. They get paid by the public or private. So their role is largely kind of demanding and or finding a way of pressuring that employer, public or private, to do that. Or I suppose, and some of them I think did this, but or they can try and get shots themselves for union members, that if their institution is not providing them. I know of some cases where that was done. You know, here, go here Saturday, blah, 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 get your vaccine, protect yourself, et cetera. So it's one of those things, since they're not the ones paying the employees, they have a little less power except for the, you know, moral suasion and pressure they can bring.
With the way Joe Biden keeps talking up unions, I sort of feel like unions are on the upswing. Do you feel that way, too?
I do, too. I think life is critical for, I think, for workers in general, and I think for the public in general. But I'm not sure a lot of our younger folks understand that, you know, wages are going up, not because of many in the Republican Party. Wages going up of demands from people, often, most of the time, led by labor unions. And also, a lot of organizing is going on where there aren't unions. And yes, they might fail here and there, like the Amazon case, but there's very courageous people. The problem, often for many of them, is that legislation has not, in other words, Democrats have not served working people as well as they should. And I think part of what our discussion tomorrow night is, how can we do that better? They've got to prove to working people that they've got their back. And that was exemplified, I think, during the pandemic and other cases where it didn't happen and where workers were taken advantage of. So, you know, is it going to happen right away? Don't know. But I'm hopeful. I do think there's a climate out there. There's some good organizing, particularly if you look at what happened with the minimum wage the last 5 or 6 years. Really good organizing. And that's been the major thing that has lifted people up. And we can say, well, $15 is not enough either, but it's a step. So, yeah, I'm a little bullish on it, and I am pleased at what certainly what Biden has done. I'm anxious to ask that question to Tom Balanoff, particularly looking at the national acts right now, is what does he think is going to happen there?
Oh, that's going to be exciting. Thank you, David. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. The town hall, again, go to goodgovernmentillinois.com, and you can sign up for this. It is free from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., Tuesday, July 20th. It's going to be a fascinating conversation. And David, thank you so much for joining us to give us a little bit of a preview.
Thank you, Joan. Appreciate your show.
Take care, my friend. We are going to take a break. And heaven help us, when we come back, we are going to be joined by the lovely and talented David Hochberg. You know, home prices have been going up. Does he see that continuing? And what, if any, impact will inflation have if, indeed, it doesn't go up and down the way Joe Biden is promising that it will? We'll have that and more right after this.
Podcasts of Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. Just search WCPT 820. Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
Every so often, we talk to the lovely and talented David Hochberg, and no matter how zen we begin, I always feel that by the end of the conversation that he is in danger of having a stroke. Perhaps today we will be able to maintain our zen throughout the entire conversation. How are you, Mr. Hochberg?
I was going to say somebody's going to need a shower because I get all lathered up here. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. You know, it's been kind of a quiet summer, kind of slowly reemerging and feeling a little nervous about that. Hey, you know, when last we talked, you were telling us all about that fundraiser. I was reading about it. You guys did a great job. You raised a lot of money. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. The listeners of Chicago raised, the Score Radio raised over $700,000 for the food, what's currently a outdoor market, for them to build a sustainable grocery store on that space. So there's going to be, the target is December 31st, there's going to be a full-fledged grocery store run by kids that go to the Helping Hand School and the Helping Hand program, run by kids overseen by the not-for-profit to provide fresh fruits and vegetables. And I think because they raise so much money that they're going to be able to bring in meats as well, fresh chicken and poultry and that sort of stuff to help that community. How great is that? That's awesome.
That's wonderful. Good work. Good work for you.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
That was good.
And now let's switch over to the subject that I know is very near and dear to your heart, houses and the housing market. We have been, at least, I don't know if it's quite the same in the downtown Chicago area, but in the suburban area, you know, real estate has been on fire. Do you see that sort of trend continuing, or are all the people who want to move to the burbs are just about there?
No, I think what's happening is that there's been another push, because if you think about it, you have to get, if you're going to send your kids to school, you have to get them registered right within the next 30 days because school starts. I mean, in 30 days, you know, depending upon where you're at, I know you're past that, but you know, all your listeners that have kids that are going to schools, they know what I'm talking about. If you want to get into a specific school district, you gotta close on that house. So, and I'll give you two examples that just happened. My in-laws, number one, We're hoping for a 60-day close. They live in Lincolnshire, Stevenson School District for high school. And they're closing in like 35 days instead of 60 because the buyers want to get in there to register their kids to go to high school. That's a fact. Another one, I have a sales rep at another radio station, lives in Oak Park, super hot, Oak Park River Forest High School, great area to raise a family. Put his house up, put their house up on the market Friday. Open house is Saturday. Open house is Sunday. After the open houses, they had 10 showings. Sold their home Sunday night for $20,000.
Wait a minute. The same Sunday night as they had the open house?
Had the open up, put the house on the market Friday, signed a contract Sunday night, 40 and up. For $20,000 above ask price. But again, if now you add the variables of low interest rate, variables of low home stock, right? The stock of homes are low. You put into the fact that a lot more of our listeners are working from homes, from their homes, and are putting money into their homes in order to stay there longer because they don't have to travel. That's why there's not as much inventory on the market because listeners are putting money back in their homes to stay there longer. And there hasn't been any major rebuild or building or any blocks of homes that have gone up since the housing bubble in 07 and 08. There's been building, but there hasn't been any mass building that we saw from 2001 up until the crash in 07, 08. So, yeah, it's been crazy.
But it's not slowing. You don't see it slowing.
I don't see it slowing. And I just got off the phone with a borrower of mine. He was one of my first radio clients 18 years ago. Still good friends with him. And he's a more experienced homeowner, if you will. He's in his late 60s. He's already retired. He spent 6 months and his wife down in Florida, bouncing around down in Florida, seeing if, you know, areas they like, where the friends are, and they're thinking of moving. He's like, yeah, we came back. Wife wants to sell the house. I want to sell the house. He's like, what do you think? I think, sell the damn house. He's like, why do you say that? He's like, well, you're at the peak of the market. You're going to sell your house in a week, and then you're going to go find a place to rent for 6, 7, 8 months. He's like, oh, I don't know if I want to rent. I'm like, then hold on to your place and miss the hottest real estate market in the history of real estate markets and sell your house next year for probably $20,000 to $30,000 less. I mean, what do you want me to tell you?
So you do think that this hot period is, it's not
sustainable.
The new normal. It is going to fade at some point.
It's going to fade. Listen, and it's not going to crash like we saw
in 2008. Yeah.
2008. It's really, it started at the end of 07 and really full blast in 08. And here's another factor. The foreclosures that I've been telling everybody about that's been overhanging this market, right? They kicked mm-hmm. that can down the track again, okay? Down the street again. So all the foreclosure proceedings that were supposed to happen on July 1st, and I'm not like a big fan. I'm not going to sound like a cheerleader, male cheerleader, because I was a male cheerleader at Northern Illinois.
You still are.
No, I still am. I still am a cheerleader. I was Victory Husky in the whatever. So I digress. But you know, all of the foreclosures that were supposed to start July 1st, 30-day moratorium, okay, from all of the alphabet suit of regulatory organizations within the federal government, the CFPB, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which is basically the FBI for the consumer side of anything lending, okay? And then you've got the FHFA, which is the Federal Housing Finance Authority. So if you just say the alphabet soup of financing organizations, it falls into this bucket. Essentially what they've done is, and I'm just doing this in Cliff Notes version, they got together and essentially said, we're pushing the foreclosure back 30 more days. So now you're at August 1st. And then what we're doing is we're putting on a 30-day buffer on top of that. So now we're at September 1st, and essentially what these two organizations have said to the servicers, again, the companies that our listeners write their mortgage payment to, saying, you better do everything in your power, turn over every rock, turn over every brick, turn over every freaking piece of wood, keep these homeowners in their homes and do workouts of these home loans. And I've talked to a couple of listeners already that have were able to qualify for 40-year fixed loans at a 2% rate. Okay, so
wait a minute, did you say 40?
40-year fixed loans.
I didn't think there was such a thing.
Congratulations. There wasn't anything like that until they just created. Actually, there were 40-year
fixed loans. Was that a test?
In 08.
Were you testing me to see if I would jump in there?
No, I don't test you because I know you'll pass it with flying colors, and I don't want to look embarrassed. But, you know, they came out with the 40-year fixed modified loans in 08, 09, and 10 when we were working all those loans out, and it worked out, okay? But it comes down to the servicers better do everything in their power because you got Mama Bear and Papa Bear above you, right? The CFPB and the FHFA, two agencies you do not want to screw with. If you're in
those are federal agencies.
Those are federal agencies that Mama and Papa Bear, you don't want to piss them off, okay? Because if you do, they have an unlimited balance sheet budget, and they'll just come after you and make your life miserable, okay? So what they basically said to every single servicer servicing Fannie, Freddie, FHA, and VA and rural loans, you better do everything in your power to make sure to try to get these borrowers, these homeowners, into modified loans. Now, here's the caveat, okay? You still have to make the taxes, and you still have to have taxes on the you still have to have insurance on the property in case of a storm, a fire, whatever, and you have to be able to pay the real estate taxes. And the challenge we have in this screwed up state that we're in is that the real estate taxes are so ungodly high that no matter if you drop the mortgage payment down to a dollar, and I'm just going for the ridiculous here in this example. And you can't make the mortgage, and you can't make the taxes and the insurance payment. You have to vacate that property because you have to give that servicer the opportunity to turn that house and get something coming in. Okay, so that's the yin to the yang. The great news is, if you're still having challenges and you're still in forbearance and you still haven't gotten back to where you were 16 months ago prior to the pandemic, this is your last hurrah. Okay, so what's going to happen? So they kick it out.
You know, hang on a second, David. We're going through a commercial break. I want you to explain this, and because I don't really understand a lot of this, you're going to have to use little words and go slowly. So let's just take a break so we can have some time to talk about this. We'll be back right after a break.
Can't listen to Joan Esposito?
Surely you can't be serious.
Live, local, and progressive in your car today?
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Don't fret. You can still listen to her on the TuneIn app on both your phone and computer.
Whoa! You feel that right away. It's just refreshing.
You're listening to WCPT 820, because facts matter.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
I am talking with David Hochberg, and the mortgage forbearance and that kind of eviction stuff I was going to get into later, but David was explaining these rules, David, they seem to change like every week. How do you keep up? Because I can't keep up. Some of the stuff you're telling me is the first time I'm hearing it. So again, explain how things stand for people who are maybe having a little bit of difficulty this summer. Damien, I can't hear David. David Hochberg, can you hear me? Did you mute yourself? Do you think we should call him again, Damien? David Hochberg. Hello? Okay. Let's just hang up and give him a call again. Oh, wait a minute. He's trying. It says he just texted me. He said he got disconnected. He's trying to call back. So either he is going to get through to Damien or they're going to completely mess up each other's calls and they're all going to get busy signals. One of the things that I was talking to David Hochberg, for those of you who missed the beginning of the conversation, was about home prices, particularly in the suburbs where people have decided that they want to get out of the city and live in a decent school district. Home prices are hot right now, but they may not be this way forever. David, you're back. So glad we have you again. I interrupted you. You were mid-thought. Please continue.
Okay, so it's very simple. If you are still in a financial crisis and you are still in forbearance, or you're still having financial challenges and you haven't asked for forbearance, forbearance is where you could defer your mortgage payment. This is your last at bat, okay? The federal government has done everything in their power to help you stay in your home. Okay, now is not the time to do the ostrich move and continue to bury your head in the sand, okay? Now is the time to call your servicer, the company you write your mortgage payment to. And if you're still having financial challenges, you need to ask them to modify your loan, okay? And here's another good thing that just happened. I had a girlfriend of mine who I've done a loans with for 7-10 years, great family, lost her job, husband didn't make enough income. I'm like, you got to call right away. Boom, put her into forbearance 15 months ago, phenomenal. She lives in the southwestern suburbs. Her taxes are $18,000 a year on a $500,000 home. Crazy. Absolutely.
That's
freaking
insane.
Crazy. It's bananas. This is why I'm telling you, these taxes are nuts. Okay, and I've been talking about it, but nobody wants to do anything in the state. But we're not getting into that right now. So let's just talk. So she's like, okay, I called up my servicer. I still don't have a job. I asked them to modify my loan. And they wanted me to come up with, you ready for this? Yeah. Over $28,000 in back real estate taxes because the servicer paid her real estate taxes for the past 16 months, okay? And her insurance, which is $1,500 to $1,800 a year, right? It was like close to 30 grand. It was ridiculous. She's like, I don't got that money. I'm like, I know you don't got that money. So she's like, and she starts crying. I'm like, listen, first of all, stop crying. If you start crying, I'm going to start crying.
Oh,
nothing.
Oh, my gosh.
So I said, here's what you do. Write this down. Call up the servicer. Try to get a hold of somebody else than the other knucklehead that you talked to. And explain to them, you have no money. Okay? Without unemployment, you won't be able to feed your family. And there's no way you're going to be able to pull 30 G's. At your rear end here to give it to them. So here's the other great thing that's come down from the alphabet soup of regulatory agencies, Mama Bear, Papa Bear, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, CFPB, and the FHFA, which is the Federal Housing Finance Authority. Okay, those are the two big ones, all right? They basically said the servicers, the company you write your mortgage payment to, have to do everything in their power to work out these loans to keep homeowners in their homes because they want to avoid what happened in 2009 and 2010 when they started going to foreclosures and people started throwing keys on the table and the economy went into a toilet bowl spiral out of control. Okay. So even the tidy bowl man would have got tipped over in that sucker. All right. Remember that? That was one of the greatest commercials ever. Okay. And the scrubbing bubbles, those two were my favorites. So I took baths a lot. So if you go back and you look at this, What FHFA and CFPB said, the servicers have to take that chunk of money, right, that is sitting there and put it back into the total amount owed on the mortgage and spread it out. So some of our listeners who qualify aren't going to qualify for the 40-year fixed loan at 2%. They're going to be able to just maybe add 10 months to the back of their loan. Right. There's a bunch of tricks in the servicer's bag of tricks that they can bring out to help keep listeners in their homes. OK. And that workaround with the escrow has taken a huge relief off of a ton of our listeners' heads because they just didn't have the money because the real estate taxes are so ridiculous in this state. OK. So that's what it is. If you're a listener still having challenges, don't sit there and do nothing. OK. This is like the third or fourth modification. How many times have I come on? I'm like, here's your deadline. Mm-hmm. You know, here's where
I know.
You look at it. right? I mean, so I'm only good at the information they come out with. So essentially, look at the calendar. July's moratorium got kicked back until August 1st. Then they put an overlay on it, and then so they bumped it back for the 30-day extra workout. Now you're at September 1st. And they essentially said that they don't see – this is just an overall macro statement by the Alphabet Soup, Mama Bear, and Papa Bear lending – that they don't see any mass foreclosures before the end of the year, okay? Which means – you go into the beginning of next year, they're not going to foreclose on people and start kicking people out in the winter, okay? That's just not the right thing to do, right? So
Right. Now
you're in the spring of next year, all right? There are workouts available to your listeners.
Okay, before we get into what those kinds of things are, we are once again taking a break for the bottom of the hour.
These commercials are ridiculous, by the way. Can I tell you that? We need to go an hour straight.
We absolutely do. But, you know, people like David Hochberg buy time on our station. Plus, I have to, Damien, let's do it now. I have to give away a $50 gift certificate to Dino's Italian Restaurant and Pizzeria. David, you're not eligible for this. So you just relax for a minute.
Delicious. But Dino's is awesome.
I know. I've eaten there. I love it. If you're the third caller to our listener line, 773-763-9278, 773-763-9278, you can walk away with a $50 gift certificate to Dino's Italian Restaurant and Pizzeria. They have homemade lasagna, meatballs, pastas, sauces, and pizza. You can eat outside in a spacious patio. You can have pickup or delivery for lunch or dinner. They're at 7004 West Higgins. That's two blocks east of Harlem in Chicago. If you do want to do carry out or delivery, call them. 773-763-4077. Our contests are open to anybody as long as you're 18 years of age or older, live in the greater Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana area. One entry per person, one winner per household, void where prohibited by law. Listeners may only win or qualify to win once every 30 days. Complete rules are on our website, WCPT820.com. Have fun. Bye.
Want to add your two cents? You can now call or text us at 773-763-9278. WCPT's text line is sponsored by GWC Injury Lawyers. Visit them at JusticeStartsToday.com. Now back to Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive on WCPT 820.
You're getting used to hearing me say this. Every time we go to a break, I'm like cutting David Hochberg off as he's about to make some really important point. Now, the question is, does David remember what he was saying to continue on the conversation? Do you remember, Mr. Hochberg?
It had to do with the Tidy Bowl Man and the scrubbing bubbles, right? Was that where we left off?
well, that was back a little further. But if we need to rewind
Dino's,
that far, we can do that.
We're talking about Dino's. How awesome Dino's is!
Yes. Well, okay. That was good too. But you got very upset with me because you were about to offer some very good advice to some of our listeners who may find themselves in a little bit of trouble this summer.
Yeah, so what our listeners have to do is, again, I stated it during the last segment, you can't do the ostrich and think this is mm-hmm. going to go away.
You know, David, that's a message that you and I have been pounding home for a long time. Is that still something that you're seeing a lot? People are just, they're overwhelmed by it, and so they literally just, well, I'll deal with it tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I talked to a guy a couple weeks ago. He's like, yeah, I haven't made my mortgage payment in about 15 months. I'm like, okay, you're on forbearance, right? He's like, nah, I never did that. I'm like, what? I'm like, all you have to do is make a call and get into forbearance. He's like, yeah, nah, I didn't do that. I'm like, okay, so what's going on? He's like, yeah, I've got this car that the bank sent somebody by once a week just to make sure I'm still living there. I'm like, well, actually, they're making sure you haven't ripped the copper out of the walls is what they're making sure, and that there isn't, major damage, because they're getting ready to kick you out, and they're getting ready to sell that house because they could sell the house in 3 days, all right? So he's like, well, I got the money. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. I'm like, what? I'm like, here's what you got to do, okay? Number one, you need to call your servicer. Number two, need to get them. You need to get a number from them to get your mortgage reinstated. Get caught up all the late fees, all the penalties, and get back on the swing of things. Because right now you're in foreclosure status. If you would have picked up the phone 15, 16 months ago and asked for forbearance, you would have been better off because you wouldn't have had any late mortgage payments showing up. I'm like, you got 16, 17 months of late mortgage payments.
He's like, well, I want to retire.
Like, yeah. Oh, I get a pair of 32-inch pants. I go, that ain't happening anytime soon, okay? So I'm like, because I'm a little bigger than 32-inch pants, in case you didn't know. So I said, what you got to do is you got to get caught up. You got to get out of foreclosure status, and you got to make your mortgage payment on time. And you can't be playing these games because they will throw you out. As soon as the forbearance, so he does not qualify. If you were late on your mortgage prior to March of 2020, and I forgot this. Thanks for letting me bring this up. So if you were late prior to March of 2020, prior to the pandemic, and you had late mortgage payments, this moratorium kickback and another, you know, kick the can down the road for 30 days and pick up another 30 days. That's not for you. Okay, you've got the benefit of everybody else having major challenges that went into forbearance because they lost a ton of money and couldn't make their mortgage payment. You're just a knucklehead, okay, who just didn't make the payment because, you know, you were waiting it out, but you had the cash sitting there. I'm like, what type of person does that? He's like, well, yeah, I don't want to spend the money. I'm like, okay, we're going to spend the money on moving trucks and a place to, you know, put your family up because they're going to throw you out. I'm like, get caught up. It, you know, this guy's father told him to call me because the father hears me on the radio and he's like, hey, you better call because they think you're in worse problems than you're letting on. I'm just like, dude, you're like nuclear war, you know, DEFCON 1 here. You're about ready to get blown up and you've done it to yourself. So we do have listeners out there that are living in another state of reality, which is, I don't know what they're doing. Because I think they felt that, you know, this foreclosure moratorium has given them a little room to maneuver here. But if you're not in forbearance and you haven't made a mortgage payment and you've had late mortgage payments prior to March of 2020, this little reprieve doesn't go to you. They're going to come and kick you out, and they're going to sell that house in 3 days is basically what's going to happen. Okay? So that's where we're at. Okay? It's a very troubling time, and we're not through this thing yet. Some of us are. We started with over 7 million homeowners in forbearance, okay? We're now down to quote-unquote, only 2 million homeowners who are still in forbearance. That's a huge drop. That's a great improvement. But for the 2 million homeowners that are still in forbearance, Joan, they're having some major economic challenges, and they haven't gotten caught up to where they were prior to us going into the lockdown in March of 2020. It's just a fact.
David, if you've gone into forbearance, will that affect your credit score if you come out in the ways that the government wants us to come out of something like this?
That's the greatest thing that has happened. If you went into forbearance, like we advised everybody to do, right? You were so gracious to have me on your radio show in March of last year when I came on and explained to everybody what forbearance was and why they needed to, like, run, not walk, but run to into this program to protect themselves. If you went into forbearance and you deferred a mortgage payment, you will not have any late mortgage reporting on your credit report. Your credit scores will not be negatively impacted. And it'll just be like an economic anomaly, okay? And it has zero negative impact on your credit score. If you're like this guy, who I just told you about, his father told him to call me, and you didn't go into forbearance, and you've been skating for the last 16 months under all CARES 1, CARES 2, your credit is like 400, okay, because you've completely destroyed your credit, and you're in some serious trouble. And it's going to take you at least 3 years to build yourself back. Those that went into forbearance, Joan, they have nothing to worry about. Now, coming out of forbearance, there are certain things that your listeners need to do. Can I cover that real quick?
You know what? So I don't interrupt you. Let's take a break, and then you can just go. You can take it up till you hear the music, okay, at the end of the show.
You got
David
it.
Hochberg.
You got it.
is giving us good advice, and we will get the rest of it when we come back after this.
There's no excuse to miss Joan Esposito.
It's number one on my stereo.
Live, local, and progressive. You can listen to her daily at WCPT820.com on your computer or phone.
Chicago's Progressive Talk, WCPT 820, where facts matter.
You know what time it is? It's time to return to the best progressive talk show in Chicago.
I'm a longtime listener.
Joan Esposito, live, local, and progressive, now on WCPT 820.
I'm speaking with David Hochberg. I have interrupted him mercilessly throughout this interview, so I told him that he now has the floor. So, Damien, get ready on that music, because we need to signal David when the time comes to really wrap things up. So get your finger, hold it over the music button.
Yeah, I prefer a 30-second bumper with It's Raining Men, because it's the greatest song ever. It's got a great beat. All right, so...
The song I play at the end of the show is not It's Raining Men, though I do agree that's a gem. The one I play is called Robot Water. And, not 30 seconds, Damien. Give him a good, there you go. Give him a good 45 seconds of that. Okay, I'm not going to interrupt you unless you say something that makes me think of a question, so go ahead, David.
It's Raining Men by the Weather Girls, greatest song ever, old school. So here, breaking news. I just got, so I'll talk about the forbearance in a second, but the FHFA, okay, Federal Housing Finance Authority, about 6-8 months ago put in an adverse market overlay for everybody that was looking to refinance that basically increased rates a quarter of a point so they could build a little buffer to weather the storm. They just announced that that's going to be being removed, so there's a refinance opportunity out there for all your listeners, not just with us, but with every lender out there. More information has to come out. Just an email was just sent by our pricing desk and saying, hey, prepare yourself. The overlay is being lifted, which means lower rates on refinances for all of your listeners in the future. Breaking news.
Wait a minute. Right, okay, I don't really understand what an overlay is, but they're going to, whatever an overlay is, they're taking it away, and that means that mortgage rates are going to drop?
Yes. Basically, what they did was FHFA, Federal Housing Finance Authority, came in and said, we're going to build in a quarter of a point pricing adjustment, okay, for all refinance transactions, so we could build up a pool of money to weather the storm for all the foreclosures and all the bad loans they thought were coming due to the economic anomaly that we were faced over the past 15, 16 months, right? We've obviously weathered the storm, and they're lifting that. So interest rates and refinances, which were a quarter of a point higher than they should have been, there was no impact on purchase transactions, just on refinances. That's going away. Don't exactly know what date it's going away, but it's going away in the very near future. Okay, great news. Now let's go back to forbearance, all right? For all of your listeners that are thinking about exiting forbearance, this is what you need to do in order to do it properly, because I've experienced this during the past 12 months of our listeners coming to us to refinance who exited forbearance, and some of the servicers have got their stuff together, and some of them have got their heads buried up their rear ends, okay? So here's what you have to do. Call your servicer, and you tell them you are in financial, you are in good financial position, you would like to exit forbearance. You will ask them, what are the different terms that they can provide to you, right, to get out of forbearance? Because you're going to owe, your listener's going to owe some sort of an amount to the servicer. If they were escrowing, they've got the escrows that they have to roll in, right? So some of the servicers will offer our listeners the opportunity to take that amount sum and spread it over a period of time and pay it back over that period of time. Some of our listeners have been using forbearance as a defensive mode and could pay all of that money back at once, right? You're always going to have a one lump sum option. And some of our listeners have that money set aside
just for an emergency because they didn't know if they were going to lose their job or get cut back at a job. So they just went into forbearance, took that money, put it into a savings account, put it in their shoebox, put it wherever, and they have that money that they can bring back and one lump sum it to your lender, okay, your servicer, mm-hmm. and get out of forbearance. The other option, which has been very popular, is that, let's just keep it simple, stupid, the KISS method. If you had 12 months of forbearance, in this example, and you had a 30-year fixed loan, so 360 months, what a lot of servicers and what the most popular option that I've experienced is that they turn your 360-month mortgage into a 372-month if you defer 12 payments, or 370 months, right, if you defer 10 payments. So those are the different options. If none of those work and you still can't make the payment, then you have to go into the modification, and that's where the 2% over 40 years comes into play. Okay? Now, here's something else your listeners have to be aware of. You have to get a signed letter from your servicer stating you are out of forbearance and have agreed to enter into one of the previously mentioned workouts. Without a letter from your servicer, you have nothing. I'm going to give you an example. We had it turns out good. It's going to sound bad, but it turns out good. We had a listener who came to us, exited forbearance in August mm-hmm. of last year. You have to make 3 mortgage payments after you exit forbearance before you can refinance in today's lower rates.
Okay. Right?
That's just a hard, fast rule. It's a stupid rule, but that's a rule that we all have to follow. I don't know why it's there. If you ask me why, I don't know. There's about 40 rules I could tell you that are just stupid. And that's like 1A, all right? So if you come out of forbearance, you have to have a letter from the servicer explaining what program you went into, the date you entered it, and you have to make 3 payments before you could refinance, okay? Lady exited, a listener exited forbearance August, September of last year. We set up her loan. We started her loan after she made her first payment, thinking that right after she makes this third payment, we'll close her loan. Loan's clear to close. Everything's good. 740 borrower, didn't lose her job. Everything's great. She's in a great position. At that time, the rates were in the mid to low 2s, ridiculous rate. So we were ready to close in January, all set, ready to go. Huntington okay. Bank was her servicer. Don't worry if Huntington's an advertiser. There's a silver lining. Huntington Bank would drag this lady through the mud for 60 days. So I kept extending the lock because I couldn't get her the rate anymore. I called Huntington Bank, right? I called up in their media relations. I'm like, listen, this lady is going to just absolutely tear you a new one. And here's what happened. I've got all the things. You guys made a mistake. Just do the right thing and just provide her with the thing. They refused. All right. Turns out we closed the loan. It cost this borrower over like $3,000, right? In extension fees. Cause if we don't close the loan within a certain amount of time, we have to extend the loan and there's a fee for that. So long story short, for the amount of money that she lost by being in the higher rate, she's like 4.5% or something. We got her in the 2s. And for all the lock extensions, it came out to about $3,000. She closed the loan. She went after Huntington Bank hard after the loan closed. Huntington Bank, after about 30 or 45 days, turned around and did the right thing and refunded her back every single penny. For some reason, the people in the banking servicing side told her to go stuff it, but the people in the customer service side said, this is wrong, we did not treat you right, and credit it all back to her. This loan should have closed. If she had the letter in August, September, when she exited forbearance, we would have been able to have closed in January. But since they never provided her with the letter, told her she was out of forbearance, has documentation from them, from, you know, verbal documentation, notes and everything else, because she's very anal retentive, ADD, all that stuff, okay? No, ADD, attention deficit disorder. She wouldn't be very anal retentive if she was ADD, but she was very, very, very detailed, had everything laid out, who she talked to, when she talked to him. But Huntington Bank then came back and did the right thing because she had detailed notes, but she didn't have the letter from them stating that the forbearance ended on this date. It was like a seven-month ordeal that ended up good. Huntington Bank did the right thing, but they dragged her through the mud for way too long, but the customer service side of it made up for what the servicing side did to her. It was wrong in so many ways. And I'm on the phone with the servicing department. I'm like, you guys did. You know, I'm like, it's clearly apparent what happened. You made a mistake. Okay, no problem. 100%. We all make mistakes. Just say you screwed up and move on. They refused to do it. So she got her money back. That's why I'm telling your listeners, advising your listeners strongly, you have to get a letter. And if they say we don't do that, that's BS. Get some written communication confirming.
Will an email count?
Ended forbearance. An email, a signed letter is better. Have them email you a letter on their stationery, okay, stating that it ended here, and these are the terms, and this is the way your loan was modified. That's all you need. And then any lender, if you want to come to us, great. You want to go to any other lender, whatever. Any lender could use that. And here's the other trick.
Well, hang on one second. I said I wasn't going to interrupt you, but we've got a caller who has a question for you. Katie's calling from Villa Park with a question for you, David. Hey, Katie, you're on with David. Go ahead and ask him your question.
Hey, Joan and David. Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, I was in forbearance and it ended last November 30th. I went to go do a refi with the Federal Savings Bank this spring, and they told me, well, it went into underwriting. We were ready to go. I had my appraisal. Well, then here, because I have an FHA loan, they said it has to be a year from the end of the forbearance. Is that true?
A year for FHA? I have not heard that. It's for 3 months.
For FHA, and the gentleman at the Federal Savings Bank said, Katie, we'll hold your file so we can do it in November. Of course, I have to have a reappraisal. And yeah, they said because I currently have FHA loan, and that's their rule, which I think is ridiculous.
But wait a minute. How much do you owe on your house?
Like $240,000.
What's your home worth?
$350,000.
And how's your credit?
It's good. I was upper 600. I'm not that great.
Right, are you mid 600s?
Yes.
Okay, you shouldn't be in an FHA loan. It's ridiculous that they offered you an FHA loan. Any bankruptcies, foreclosures, anything like that? Any credit challenges?
No. I have
a Fannie Mae Freddie Mac loan with no PMI.
So I shouldn't have to have an FHA loan.
Here's what I'll do for you, because you sound like a nice lady and you're a friend of Joan, and then I take care of all of Joan's listeners. If you give me a call after the show, I'll give you my number. I'll take a look at your file and I'll give you an honest, free consultation. Okay. How's that?
Oh, that's great, David. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you.
And nothing against the Federal Savings Bank. I don't need them coming after me. All right, but I'm just saying that. A lot of listeners are in loans that they shouldn't be in. Okay, if you have a $200,000 loan and your house is worth over $300,000, that's like 60-70% loan to value. Unless the borrower has major credit challenges, there's no reason for that borrower, this listener, to be in an FHA loan. Okay, you should be in a Fannie Mae Freddie Mac loan. You don't have any upfront mortgage insurance, and nothing against FHA loans. We do hundreds of them, thousands of them a year, hundreds of them a month. I'm just saying that if the borrower, you've got to put borrowers in the right pair of shoes, Joan, because as you know, you look fantastic in the black patent leather shoes. Every time we go out, you wear them. I love them. I'm just saying, like, it's not one size fits all.
Damien is getting Katie's information, so he hasn't started the music, but we are running up against the computer. Thank you, my friend.
We'll
make sure you and Katie get connected. And there's so much to talk about. We're going to get you on again in a few weeks. All righty?
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That is going to be it for me today. Santita will be here tomorrow at 6 a.m. Stay safe, my friends, and have a good evening. Good night.